Welcome to Indy Radio Garden. This week's highlights from community radio in the Philadelphia region.
This program brings ordinary citizens to the air to discuss issues related to health, race, safety, workers' rights, and the will to survive in pandemic times.
The first audio comes from WPEB 88.1 Scribe Radio from the show Jubilee Voices. The kids hosted the show, Aya, Sheena, Kevin, Kennelin, and Kennedy are fourth graders of the Jubilee Elementary School. They interviewed the poet Sonia Sanchez about racial disparities and racial discrimination.
Hello, West Philadelphia. Welcome to Jubilee Voices. Today we have a special guest that the fourth grade Jubilee School will introduce.
We would not have the freedom fighting power we have today if it wasn't for Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, and the woman with razor blades between her teeth, Sonia Sanchez.
Sonia Sanchez is a poet.
She turns her poems into atomic bombs to destroy lies and tell the truth.
She makes you look deep into your heart.
Her poems are like torches lighting the pathway to freedom, making Black people more realized and radiant.
Sonia Sanchez's poetry is extraordinary.
She has her own kind of rhythm. The music in her poems is like spice to her words.
Sonia Sanchez is an indomitable, courageous, freedom-fighting woman in her journey for justice and equality for all.
What was it like for you at Hunter College?
Well, I went to Hunter College in the early 1950s, before any of you were born. And it was a school for women, a college for women. Someone had left the college a beaucoup of money to educate women. Isn't that amazing? And so I did not have to pay money. What I had to pay for merely was what they called a registration fee, which was really minuscule, which was very little. But I didn't have to pay for my courses, and I didn't have to pay for my books. The books were given to us at the beginning of the semester, and at the end of the semester, we had to give them back for the group of people coming behind us. But I received the free education. However, I did feel estranged from Hunter, because quite often I was the only Black in a class, or maybe there was another Black person in the class. If there were sometimes two of us in the class, the teacher could not seem, the professor could not seem to get our names clear between the two of us. So she would call me Miss Brown and the other person, you know, Miss whatever the last name, Miss Williams, whatever. And we would both look up at the same time. But the thing that I began to look at is that every time a picture of a Black came up, especially in the history classes, it was like a picture about a Black eating a watermelon, ooh, you know, saying something really like, ooh, this watermelon sure is good. And that was part of a history book, whatever. So you never saw us in a state of well-being. We were always in a state of stupor, eating watermelon, or like, you know, or just standing up, just staring. So I knew nothing about our history and history. We never got anything that Black folks did anything important in the world. All we saw, the only time we saw a Black person was that an enslaved Black person, and they were not necessarily just picking cotton, but they were eating watermelon, you know, and everybody saw that in class and they laughed. I didn't laugh. I remember sitting in a very stoic position, not moving. And I wanted to shrink down in my seat and not be seen. That is why I began to help form Black Studies in America. I said out loud that no Black person or no person of color or no person, you know, who came from a family that was not in quote rich or whatever would never get into a classroom and never see themselves. That Black and Puerto Rican and people of color and Asians have got to see themselves, you know, in textbooks. Otherwise, they will not know who they are, and they will constantly feel inferior in a classroom. If you feel inferior, you don't learn well at all. You tend to be very quiet, as I was, and you sit back and observe, and you very seldom participate in a conversation because, you know, at some particular point, you knew that that picture would be always a reminder of the students as they looked at you. So my whole quest, my whole movement after I was out of college and going to NYU, and some people came around and said simply, we need to begin something called the Black Arts Movement. A man by the name of Leroy Jones or Amidi Baraka, the great, great poet, a great, great playwright, a great writer, sent letters to all of us, all the artists in New York City after Malcolm was assassinated, and the letter said, come meet with me in Harlem. We are going to continue the work of Malcolm X. And all of the artists, the musicians, the painters, the storytellers, the poets, right? You know, all of these people came and gathered at a place called BART, the Black Arts Repertory Theater, that was in Harlem. Brother Baraka moved from the village and came up to Harlem, got an apartment in Harlem, and began that whole process of let us do for ourselves up here. And we would have Saturday classes for children. I and Barbara Hamilton and one other sister did the curriculum for the Saturday program. And we would get the children early in the morning, and they would do classes, they would do remedial work. We would do poetry. We would do plays with them. We would do mathematics with them, geography with them, so they could be up to par when they went to school in September. But above all, it was the cultural part that we did with them, the cultural part that we brought the poets to them and the musicians to them and began to make them understand just what an important role we played in culture in America, although no one ever talked about that. And so when the Black Arts Repertory Theater sort of like, you know, went out of business in a sense because of some difficulties, I was approached by phone and in person by people, by students from San Francisco State, people who came to see us in New York, Jimmy Garrett. The other person's name is, I don't know why I'm blanking on his name. I can't believe that. Came along to see to it that they wanted to talk to me, and they wanted to talk to Baraka, also at that time, Leroy Jones, to come out to San Francisco State and to do something really that had not been done before on a large scale. Let us have a Black Studies program where all of the work, it would be Black history. I taught literature, Black literature, right? Writing. Children would write about themselves. Young people would write about themselves and not be told, as many have been told before, don't keep writing about yourself. Don't keep writing about your father. I mean, write about the larger things. And so the people made you leave your area, your arena of comfort, of family, to write about other things out in the world when you needed to write about what was going on in your home, in your family, in the country, in the world, you know, and about the history of Black people or Latino people or Asian people, all of those things we needed to do. So we understood that. And so I went out to a place called San Francisco State and began to teach what I call Black English, Black Lit. We began to do cultural programs. We would do poetry readings on Wednesdays, and we would feed the students when they came in. And it was always packed with Black and Latino students and Asian students. They were there, and some white students came out to hear people read poetry, read excerpts from plays, hear the things about themselves, you know, or what that was about. And so I began to teach, and one day, one of the teachers came in, professors came in and said, Sonia, here's a poster. It's a poster. We think it's about Asian Americans here, Japanese Americans here in San Francisco. And it was a poster that said, report at a certain time on a certain corner because they were being sent out of San Francisco because of what had happened during World War II. And what I found out at that particular time from that poster and from doing some research, I found out that Japanese Americans had been put in concentration camps during World War II. And when I approached two of my Asian students, right, my Japanese American students, I approached them and I showed the poster to them. They got very angry at me. I said, well, I don't know. I'm not sure, but I think this is about concentration camps and about Japanese Americans being put in concentration camps. I'm going to do more research on it. And I said, but whatever you do, take the poster home to your family and ask them. And they kind of grabbed the poster and left, you know, in a big, like, oh, I mean, they were really annoyed at me. But they came back to class on the following Tuesday, and they had tears in their eyes, and they had gone home and asked their parents if they had ever seen a poster like this, and their parents started to cry and to tell them a story about concentration camps, right? You know, where they lived, how they were taken, how they had to sell their houses, mind you, in 1 week, how they lost money on that, how they could not take any of their furniture. It's just they just had bags of their clothing and things like that. And they were in these concentration camps. So that was what was so important. When you began to talk about yourself, about being Black in America, then I found out about Chinese Americans going out in the Midwest, helping to build the railroads. Isn't that amazing? I found out about Black folks also too, that they were just more than cotton pickers, right? You know, I found out so very much about what it was to be Black. I found out about the writers that we had. I found out about Harriet Tubman bringing people out of slavery to freedom. I have a Harriet Tubman collection of a poem, a haiku poem to her. I mean, a great, great person. She was called General Tubman because she was so fierce and she led people out. Coming, can you imagine cutting through slave plantations, you know, coming out at night, bringing all of this, many of these enslaved people to freedom, to a place called Philadelphia and to a place called Canada. This was the amazing thing about us. So I learned about the bravery of African Americans and how brave we were. We were not just going around going, yeah, I love watermelon, you know, right? We were going around doing very important things, helping people to run, to move out of our enslavement, you know, teaching children, you know, there, you know, as they grew up, right? I learned about Frederick Douglass, you know, who always had food because he lived on the plantation. So he would give this food to poor white children, you know, and they would write and have, he would have them write on the sidewalk, you know, the alphabet. So he could learn how to write the alphabet. Isn't that ingenious? I mean, they were smart, you know. I mean, smart like you children are, you young people are. That's why I'm always so happy to come and see you because you are so smart, you know, and so bad, right?
From the Neighborly Chats program, David Giroux interviews George Dakopoulos, owner of the Melolani Cafe, about how he built community with other businesses and among the neighborhood of Mount Airy Germantown during the pandemic.
You're listening to Neighborly Chats on WRGU 92.9 FM. On today's episode, I'm talking to George Dakopoulos, the owner and manager of Melolani Cafe.
My name's George Dakopoulos, and I'm the owner-operator of Melolani Cafe. The location is 6734 Germantown Avenue. We're in Mount Airy, which I love Mount Airy. I think it really picked me. And I've been here almost 7 years in September.
One of the first things I learned was that Melolani Cafe's first location was down the Jersey Shore, and they eventually moved to Mount Airy in Philadelphia.
Yeah, so I had the same kind of cafe down at the shore in Ventnor, one block from the beach, and we had been there for 8 years. But the shore was changing, there was hurricanes, and then also casinos closed, you know? So we started scouting, and we started from South Philly. I used to come up on a train, like, once a week, you know, just scout like South Philly and then Passyunk and each little area of Philly until like I got to Manayunk. And then every time we would like look for properties to look at, and this was available. So it really spoke to us. And I think Mount Airy picked me. We had breakfast and lunch restaurants originally at the shore. After I graduated college, then I went to South Africa for like 6 months, and I worked in coffee shops. So when I returned, I decided to open a European style cafe, you know, so because South Africa is very diverse, especially Johannesburg, you know, so being a little bit international is, you know, it's awesome. And I think Johannesburg definitely gives you the taste of the entire world. And I think being in a very diverse area in Philly and Mount Airy, that's why I like it a lot too, you know. You know, we do a lot of events too. So we're a small cafe, but we do like open mics Thursday, and we do live music every Friday and Saturday pre-COVID. So we had a nice music scene.
Next, I asked George about the challenges and experiences that the COVID pandemic presented him.
So as soon as the corona hit, I basically had to let go of my employees, and I just operated by myself. I was actually very lucky because I was in a program called Power Up Your Business, which is really a good program that any small business, I think the soda tax helps pay for this, so small businesses can apply. It's a free class. It's run by the Philadelphia City. So they coached me and they told me to invest in my website and online ordering because it's going to be a lot of to-go, you know? And also, pre-COVID, I thought like the music was such a big part of my business, but what turned out to be is like the food is very popular. At first I was by myself and I was just operating, you know, just trying to get by, and it got too busy after a couple months. You know, I think by June I brought back like one or two employees, and by August, you know, just so much to go. So you can only take so many orders over the phone, you know, but when you have online ordering, it's just multiple people can order and you don't have to be answering the phone, you know. So that's why it worked out so much for me too, you know, because the phone was off the hook. I'd have just like an employee to answer the phone the whole times at some point, you know, especially like, I guess after like around August, September, we started to get busier too, you know. The hardest part is also to keep safe and keep my employees safe. So that was a whole new world, like understanding the virus, like how is it transmitted? You know, at first, remember initially it was like by surfaces was a big thing, but then later it was really by, you know, breath, you know. So definitely like all the gloves and like the masks and like getting the employees to wear the mask correctly. And then like getting the customers to wear the mask, because like there's all this like half stuff going on. So, you know, and actually now I'm doing much better than I was almost doing before COVID. It's because people need food too, you know, and they don't have much else to do right now, you know, so they're really invested in food, you know. And people just bought gift cards to support me. People send me money, you know, like, so this, and I was here just long enough for like 6 years that people know. So they really did support me in this area. Some people were like, you know, you shouldn't be using these containers, try this container. So they helped me also to understand like what they want as customers to be like felt safe. So I've made it through COVID because I was small, you know, and I think it's really important to be able to, you know, always have butts and seats, you know, basically. But with the way things are with takeout, you know, now I guess the world is my oyster. You know, these ghost kitchens don't need seats. Do you know what I mean? They just need a facility, and then you can get out to wherever now. I'm in another class, it's called the Goldman Sachs. It's like the next one, which is also a city-run program, and it's at the Philadelphia Community College. And it really helped me to grow my business. I think it was really clutch. And I went to Stockton University, which I took a business and hospitality degree. And it's always good to be able to go back to like school and like, because this stuff's so hard, man. You know? And wearing all the other hats is difficult, you know, because there's a lot of, you know, marketing, and also hiring is just a whole science. It's true, you know, managing people, they're so much part of the community too, you know, so I think you got to take care of your employees. And I don't have a problem with finding staff, because I think we do a good job with our employees. So, and this area definitely has a lot to offer in the way of employees. You know, there's a lot of people that need jobs, I think.
One of George's relationships that was strengthened during the pandemic was his relationship with Nick and Jess of Mount Airy Groceries, whose nonprofit he helped nurture during its infancy.
Then actually Jessica was working with us. She started her thing here in the summertime too.
Right.
And she started off on her porch, and then she needed some space, and then she came here, and it was too large for here. So that was something that was cool. We actually got on 6ABC on the news on a Saturday night at 6 o'clock because we were doing, you know, these boxes, and so it was like a lot of exposure, too. You know, she's really good with that, too, but that's her vehicle because she's trying to get to the community, so she needs those kind of avenues like you, too. So, and me, too, I think, you know, so it's really, she was just doing it, you know, like, I just let her have some space, you know what I mean? But then she grew out of the space, and now that's why she's there. Especially when you open a business like a cafe, your doors are open to the community. So you always feel like, what can I do on my end? Especially, and I'm feeding people, so like, you know, how can I help? You know, and she was a friend and customer of ours already. So, and she's so self-motivated, it made so much sense because it wasn't like, I didn't have to take on a big part of this project, even though it was like some stuff, you know, but it's about the people too, you know, like it was easy to work with her and Nick, you know, and they were displaced because they were working at the, like the catering place down the street. So they closed and they're like, what can we do too, you know? So I think it was just, it made sense because I was closed on the inside. I wasn't doing anything on this side of the store and it was fun. And they'd like a lot of, I used produce. So I was able to get produce too, but I delivered a lot of boxes too, so that was also fun, you know.
As previously mentioned, the live music aspect of Malalani Cafe is an important one for George for a variety of reasons.
Yeah, so basically when we were at the shore, because we had, you know, we're open during the winters, and we needed to do stuff, so we did open mics, and, you know, because it would make sense, because nobody had stuff to do on the island. And once we started doing it there, then I just always continued to do it. So even when I opened here, before I even was allowed to, like, serve food, we were still doing music, because we could use the space for that, you know. In this area, and in Philadelphia, too, the music scene is really live here, too. So, and I'm a musician, and my employees are musicians, so it's like, you know, it's a lot of fun for us to be able to, you know, like burn steam or just, you know, it gives us another reason to like work. A lot of people, their music stays within the walls, that energy. We used to do a lot of art shows too, which we will do again. We did have to go to virtual open mics, but we were able to do that too. So it was nice that we were able to continue to do that. Definitely they supported me through the COVID. They were the ones that would buy gift cards or buy their friends food through gift cards or do what they can. You know, and they transitioned too, like getting used to playing in front. And now they're just like got backgrounds and all kinds of stuff going on, you know. So now we're doing music outdoors.
Oh, nice.
There's a little garden next door. It's a newer business too. She's it's called Grow, Sip, Repeat, and it's a little flower and tea shop, but she has a nice garden. So sometimes I rent it, and then we have outdoor events there, you know, just trying to keep it safe. So that's why I try to have a lot of outdoor events, and, you know, because a lot of elderly, you know, in this area like to come and do the music stuff. So right now we just have like a hybrid of an open mic, which we do in person or and virtually. So we have like a big TV. So like some of the acts are virtual. We picked up people from like Boston and stuff like that. So they still want to perform. And then like some of the acts are live. So that's every Thursday. Today, because of the weather and it's outdoor, we're just going to go strictly virtual. And then every Saturday and Sunday, we have music from 1 to 4. We're just trying to support music and then have a little bit of a crowd, you know, and we used to have it on Fridays and Saturday nights, and now we have it during the daytime because we want to have it outside and have it safe. So it's definitely changed. You know, I guess, I don't know what I'm going to do once it goes back to 100% indoor seating, you know, but I think that was a big, like, avenue for me to be such a big part of the community was through music, you know, just giving people to play music. It's weird what it does for the community, you know, when it's like a hub. Like, we're BYOB, but no one really abuses it because, you know, we have, like, kind of, like, an older crowd, you know, not, like, young. So people bring, like, wines and six-packs and, you know, don't really abuse it for driving and stuff. They're very responsible. So it's like a perfect little heaven, you know?
In fact, a big reason why live music is so important is because George himself is a musician.
Yeah, I play the bass, and then I like to play guitar, too. We do have a keyboard here, so I definitely dabble in that, you know. So, yeah, initially, you know, like, I would, like, you know, someone would come in, can I get a coffee? And they'd be like, sure. And then I was like, can I play your guitar? I'm like, sure. And they'd be like, doo-doo-doo. I'd be like, if coffee's free, the next guy would come in, the same thing would happen. I'd be like, I'm not going to make any money this way. There's such amazing musicians like in this area. It's so cool. You know, like, there's a lot of churches in this area, and that's where a lot of good like musicians, yeah, you see it every like Saturdays and Sundays, just like in the churches, people walking in drum sets and, you know, saxophones and, like, you know, the kind of singing that's real strong, you know, especially at open mics. There are a lot of places like you, where you begin as a musician, you know, and you'll see someone come who's like, you know, not really played in front of people, come to an open mic and like play in front of people, and then you just see this, oh my god, I'm addicted to this now, you know, like they like me, you know, and then like I liked it, and they come back the next week and they're a little bit better, and then they play like a couple more covers, and then they're writing their own music. You can see the evolution, and then you don't see them again because they're playing other places, you know what I mean? So I think that's really cool to see people grow musically, and that's, the musicians here are so inviting to play with each other too, so it's like getting to play with like flautists. I've played with so many of them too, and they all want to play with me, but half the time I have to cook anyway, you know? So like, there's such a great music scene and vibes. It was definitely something that really helped me to grow with the community here too.
Finally, I asked George about the impact he wants to have on his community with Malalani Cafe.
First, the most important thing is always keeping my block clean, whatever, where my space is. And then, you know, having an open door, because, you know, I really feel people, you know, sometimes coming in of a different, you know, ethnicity, and then they come in and they feel like not welcome, you know. So I think that was really eye-opening to me to see, like, people, you know, not everyone feels welcome coming into, you know, like spaces. So being somewhere where I can feed everybody and like everyone feels welcome, I think is such an important thing right now. That's one thing I heard after like what we went through as a country and the protests and stuff, you know, like one woman said, like, you can make your business of like a way to help, you know. So not only can I hire, you know, local people, you know what I mean, but I can, you know, there's other things I can do too, you know. So definitely making it a place for everybody, I think, is, it sounds simple, but it's not, you know.
Once again, Malalani Cafe is located at 6734 Germantown Ave. I'd like to thank George Trakopoulos for talking to me, and I'd also like to thank you, the listener, for tuning in to this episode of Neighborly Chats. My name is David Juro, and you've been listening to WRGU LP 92.9 FM.
Thanks for joining us. My name is Latif White. I'm the operations manager from WJYN 98.5 FM Uptown Radio. Indie Radio Garden is a Prometheus Radio Project production.